everyone. Well, welcome to Stutter Talk, episode 367, recorded and published September 26, 2012. I'm your host, Peter Reitzes, here with return guest Stutter Talk advisor, Dr. Gerald McGuire. How are you today, Dr. McGuire?
Very, very good, Peter. Thank you.
I want to let the listeners know up front that you are on a cell phone today because we were having a little trouble with your landline, so you won't sound as good as usual, but our topics are so exciting that we didn't want to put this off for a few more weeks. So I hope everybody understands. Dr. Gerald McGuire is a person who stutters, the director of the Kirkup Center for the Medical Treatment of Stuttering at the University of California, Irvine, and has researched the medical treatment of stuttering for more than 15 years. Is it 20 years now, or is it still just more than 15?
I guess research began early in my residency, so almost 20 years, between 15 and 20 years. First publication was 1994, so began that study with nimodipine was our first one, and that so probably about 1993 was when we started that trial. Yes, we're talking 19 years.
So almost 20 years. I'll change that. Almost 20 years. Dr. McGuire is certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology, is a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and is author of Without Hesitation, Speaking to the Silence and the Science of Stuttering, that's available through the National Stuttering Association. And it's a really great book because it's packed full of information about the medical treatment of stuttering, but it's written for a general audience, so it's not going to overwhelm people with sciencey language. Is that about fair?
Yes, very, very fair, Peter. Thank you very much.
And I am Peter Reitzes, as a person who stutters and a speech language pathologist. So, Dr. McGuire, we have two big topics to speak about today. You have published a bunch of small studies, I guess some big studies too, in the last few months. And we're going to talk about deep brain stimulation. And then in the second part of the show, we're going to talk about your research on acenapine. So you have, I don't know what you call it, a short study or a letter to the editor out on a case study on deep brain stimulation in the American Journal of Psychiatry. Could you tell the listeners about that case study?
Yes. So it's not a research study. It's just more of a case observation. And at times when we have a unique case in medicine, it can be worthy of journal publication if it's so novel and unique and can yield new insights about a new diagnosis or a new treatment. So just to give you a little bit of background, neurosurgery has advanced such that our colleagues in that field can place reversible electronic electrodes deep in the brain to stimulate certain regions of the brain and to treat certain conditions like Parkinson's disease or tremors. And these are also being studied to treat even neuropsychiatric disorders like obsessive-compulsive disorder. So they have identified certain targets of the brain where different nerve fibers come together or where a certain nucleus of the brain may not be functioning well, and placing a little electrode in there, which they're able to guide through MRI guidance and make sure they miss blood vessels as they place it. And they place this implant deep within the brain and run a little wire through that into a little like a pacemaker that's placed in the chest, and it constantly sends an electronic signal. This has been found to improve symptoms in patients with tremor, improve symptoms of patients with Parkinson's disease, and even looking at other conditions, more specifically, recently the controlling symptoms of obsessive compulsive disorder, which people know that may have an overlap with stuttering. So just an observation, there was a woman in her 60s who developed a fairly severe tremor. And with this tremor, she had had not responded to medical treatments, and she was referred by her neurologist to a neurosurgeon for one of these deep brain implants. Now, what's unique, this is also a woman who had developmental stuttering since she was a little girl. And she had the device implanted in the ventral medial thalamus, left-sided, and when it was turned on, because you can just place the electrode and not turn the device on as they were turning the device on. And what's interesting too, Peter, people are awake during this procedure. So you're having a brain surgery, and you know, you don't have pain fibers in your brain. So as they're placing this, the neurosurgeon say, how do you feel? How do you feel? How do you feel right now as they turn the device on? It's really pretty remarkable surgery to think about that. And they turned the device on, and lo and behold, her tremor was getting better. You know, they were able to monitor her tremor. That's why they went in there, to treat the tremor. And her stuttering gets better. Amazing, amazing story. And her stuttering continued as long as the device was on. Her stuttering had stopped. And one of the nurse practitioner who worked in the office had heard of our work here at the University of California in Irvine in stuttering. And she contacted me about a month later and said, Dr. McGuire, I know you research different medical treatments of stuttering, and you've got to hear about this case of a woman that we treated. And I traveled to the office and arranged a time to meet with the woman. She's a fantastic person, as I think all individuals who stutter are. We,
sure.
You know, we're a little bit biased there, Peter, right?
But, of course.
I met with her, and you know, she has, you know, the classic case of developmental stuttering with avoidances and you know, facial grimacing associated with her speech, and you know, growing up with the stigma of stuttering. And then she just said, you know, I have this newfound freedom, which was the device was on. And I said, you know, you can remotely turn the device off with just a little wand and a little computer. You can turn the settings down and have it not emit an electric impulse. And with her neurosurgeon, I said, now would you be willing, that you've had this place now for a few months and you're doing very well, would you be willing for us to record you and with the device on, and then would you be willing for us for just a few days or even a day to just turn the device off and see what happens? And she said, sure, I love, because we're just trying to find out. You know, you're the first person really for developmental stuttering who's had this placed, at least that we know of. And we did that, and almost immediately your stuttering comes right back. And with the same physical concomitants, eye blinking, grimacing, yeah.
It's kind of like when a person is using a device like the Speakeasy and they take it off, and they may, or they often go back to the stuttering they had before the device was turned on. You know, when I saw this study or this case study, I was sort of, the first thing that came to my mind was, people have been saying for years, there's nothing new in stuttering treatment. Could this be something new? I mean, this sounds like
Absolutely.
Something new.
It, not only is it something new, Medtronic, a company that makes these deep brain implants, they're not the only company that makes a deep brain implant, and I have no financial dealings, of course, with Medtronic. Have never published research with them or consulted with them, so just so your audience is aware.
Sure.
But they filed a patent on treatment of stuttering some years ago that a deep brain implant could potentially treat stuttering. And that may have been based upon, I don't know their thought process, but just some of the brain imaging work that we've done that implicate these certain tracts in the brain of the basal ganglia being involved in stuttering, and that you could theoretically go in and correct that tract with a deep brain implant. So they did something completely new. And there are cases of people beginning to stutter if these implants are placed in a different part of the brain. That's been shown. There are cases of treating acquired stuttering with a deep brain implant. But this is the first case that we know of actually treating someone with a developmental stuttering from a young age with a deep brain implant.
Yeah, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I noticed that there's a study that is, it looks like it's almost published from a French group, where the title suggests they found the same thing you did. That this,
oh, really?
Yeah, I will look that up as we're talking. Yeah. I wrote the lead author and said, can you send me a copy of your findings? But I haven't heard back from them yet. But it looks like they have found the same things that you have. Like they have done the surgery with a developmental stutterer for Parkinson's, and the result was less stuttering. But
yes.
I will do a PubMed search on that as we are talking. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to bring that up real quick, okay? Could you just wait one second?
Yeah. No, I'm going to go to PubMed as well. So
Dr. McGuire and I are back on. We just both went to PubMed, and there's a study that was just put up by a French group, and the title is Improvement in Developmental Stuttering Following Deep Brain Stimulation for Parkinson's Disease. So what do you think? Does it look like your two groups are onto the same thing here?
Absolutely. Let me just read it to you real quickly so you can talk. It's really short.
Okay. So, please go ahead.
So he had the Medtronic device placed, same device, postoperative, so the location electrodes were the bright, subthalamic nucleus. So this is similar region, but not exactly the same. Patient's speech improved following surgery. He developed Parkinson's at age 46. So he was in his early 50s when this was done, developmental stuttering. And had expected dysarthria worsened on stim, but stuttering did not. Efficient fluency and efficacy of speaking improved after surgery. He really had no stuttering after surgery. So this is a single case study, a deep brain stimulation from France for a gentleman with Parkinson's.
It's kind of exciting, huh?
It's very exciting to see two different groups coming up with the same thing. And we didn't even know about each other because mine was published in July and his was published in August.
So let's remind everyone, this is Stutter Talk. I'm Peter Reitz, is here with Dr. Gerald McGuire, and we're discovering related research as we discuss and do this podcast. So let me ask you a bunch of questions. Can we do some rapid fire questions and answers? Is that possible?
Absolutely.
So Luke DeNille from the University of Toronto is a Stutter Talk advisor, and he's really into research and the brain. And he helped me prep the show a bit. So he gave me some really good questions to ask you. So actually, one question that Luke said was, how strong was the effect? Was frequency as well as severity affected in your case study?
Yes. It appears to be in the French case study as well, too.
Excellent. So the second question is, as far as long-term effects, how long was the positive effect observed, and has it changed over time?
Right, so this individual has had the positive effect for now going out to 2 years.
Excellent. I like this fast question and response. Excellent. So what other changes were observed in the patient's speech? Did speech become slower, or was the patient speaking in shorter utterances?
After the treatment, there was really no from our readings, there was no deficits in the naturalness of speech, Peter.
Mm. So it's not as if they noticeably slowed down. Were there any other changes in the patient's affect? For instance, did the patient become more listless or less effective?
You know, not what was reported. Yes, I didn't meet with her before treatment. The only treatment I saw was when we turned it off for a little while. But nothing of that was reported by the patient when we had her just retrospectively go back and say, how were you before this? And if anything, her affect was brighter because not only did she feel relief of her stuttering, she felt relief of her tremor as well.
Luke yeah. also wanted to know about medication. Was the patient in your case study also taking medication that may have affected stuttering behaviors?
No.
No. So even after the surgery, they weren't on any... Oh, wow. Okay. I just assumed that they would be on something. Was there any transfer effect? So when you turned off the device, did they have some carryover for less stuttering?
When they turned it, meaning that when they turned it off?
I guess that's a hard question because it sounds like the original group who did the surgery probably didn't take a baseline of stuttering before the surgery.
They did not because they weren't really targeting the stuttering.
Sure. So
they were,
So after the surgery, when you turn off the device, the stuttering kind of came back. And then when you turn the device back on, now I've seen the surgery done on YouTube and it's amazing because the person's awake. And I actually saw one patient playing the violin while, his or her doctors were putting the electrodes in. It was unbelievable. Now, so did the patient in your case study have two electrodes put in the brain?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, let me go back to the case because I have to look at her record really quickly. It was just the left. So as we go back, she just had the left ventral intermediate nucleus of the thalamus, and our French colleagues had bilateral subthalamic nuclei. We may actually have, they place a bilateral, but maybe the left is what was really treating it. So ours was, the patient was just on the left side.
Now, so I have seen some, there was one study I saw where they actually found that this surgery increased stuttering, brought stuttering back for somebody. What do you make of that sort of conflicting case study?
Depends on where the electrode is placed.
Oh.
So, in other words, the key to all this is can we identify the target area where if we place this electrode, we can make stuttering better, or if you place it in the wrong, so you can think of that. But I think that what this really does settle, or at least begin to settle the argument, is that stuttering is a brain disorder, and that subcortical structures, the thalamus and the basal ganglia, play a significant role in stuttering treatment, potentially, all the fibers from wherever could be really the general switchboard of the brain, where all these fibers are coming together, relaying up to the cortex, and an implant just at the right area where all these particular tracks come together could make stuttering better. Or if you place it in the wrong area, you could induce stuttering. That's really where it is. So you have to identify the particular target and make sure you got it right. Now, what's good, in the OR, you can advance it, turn on the device, say, how you doing, and measure the stuttering right then and there. And you can also I'm not an expert on this because I'm not a neurosurgeon, but you can do certain microelectronic testing to determine which areas may be overactive and which areas may be underactive in that region, and place the electrode to see to modify that region to see if you turn down a certain area, would the stuttering get better? If you turn on a certain area, would the stuttering actually get better? So really where you might see the discrepancy on some cases where individuals who've had these treatments and have never stuttered before begin stuttering, it may be because where it's being placed and where individuals are having it placed for tremors or Parkinson's in a certain region, stuttering actually getting better.
Now, one of the things that Dr. Luke Danil said to me, and I'm going to paraphrase him here, was he thought it was really remarkable. What your case study said to him was that it's remarkable that you're sort of indicating that the thalamus and the basal ganglia is important in controlling fluency and stuttering. Do you think that's about right?
Yeah. Yes, I do. So, that's been our brain imaging research with fluorodeoxyglucose. Way back, we were the first group to do PET imaging, to publish PET imaging in stuttering. We implicated the basal ganglia as being very important in stuttering. much of the O15, the oxygen 15 work, really doesn't, and you know, Luke would know this bit better, doesn't really image those deep-seated structures as well. They've been more focused on the cortex, which could be further downstream in the whole process of stuttering, or upstream potentially as well, too. So, it's not before even these deep brain implants were recent cases were coming to light. We did publish the role potentially of the basal ganglia, and there's even work, old neurosurgical work, where perturbation or ablation of the thalamus for these other disorders actually led to improvement in stuttering. This is old research from the 90s. So this type of surgery of turning off a certain region of the brain in the thalamus or the basal ganglia is not necessarily new. Neurosurgeons have been doing this work for Parkinson's for 15 to 20 years. The advantages to these deep brain implants is they're reversible. In the old days, they'd go in and they would just cut out a little region or ablate a little region, and that would interrupt the fibers. Now you could place a little electrode, and when you turn it on, that region is either stimulated or turned off. And it's reversible because all you have to do is just turn off the device.
So if I understand it correctly, and if I'm way off, just let me know, but with stuttering, the research you've done with pharmaceuticals is trying to reduce dopamine in the brain, but with Parkinson's, they're trying to increase it. Is this, if I could just say it this crassly, is this research, is this a dopamine thing? What's going on here?
I don't know if it's a dopamine thing, but it's a region of the brain where dopamine is quite rich, and it's going to be a more direct way where what all dopamine does is it helps to communicate the electrical impulse from one nerve cell, one brain cell to the next. So, and that is done in a way that's systemic. So you can have side effects in the body where you might have weight gain or muscle stiffness or because you're affecting dopamine throughout the body. This is a more targeted way potentially of actually placing an implant there. So with the pharmaceutical, it's, you know, overall less invasive because you're not doing an operation. You're not doing surgery, but you are saying, I'm going to try to flood the brain region and hopefully hit that particular area that might be involved in stuttering.
Now, do you want to speculate of what's happening? Like, what is the deep brain stimulation doing that is affecting stuttering? Do you care to speculate?
You know, I will when I study these circuits a little more. I have to, you know, which is great. So I have to look at, and I'm actually doing this month right now. I'm really with a PhD student that I'm with who has actually earned her PhD in basal ganglia research and the various different connections. We're based upon the models that we have for pharmaceuticals and the models that we have currently for brain imaging and that what we have from deep brain, really map out a model of stuttering with the basal ganglia, the thalamocortical circuits to say we think that this is really the circuit. And then if we target this particular region, we can treat developmental stuttering, or if you implant this region, you can bring about stuttering. So to really get that circuit down.
So let me ask you just one last question regarding deep brain stimulation and stuttering. Where do you go next?
Yeah. They have to do these two cases, both the one in France that you just found for me. So thanks, Peter. This is a great call.
I have to say it was Luke DeNille who showed it to me.
Oh, Luke. Perfect. This is great. So, you know, with our case published in July and study for France just published in August, and here we are in September. This is great. Everything is coming together. Both these cases were individuals who were primarily not being treated for stuttering. They were being treated for a movement disorder, in one case a central tremor, another case in Parkinson's, and they were both individuals who happen to be developmental stuttering, and the stuttering gets better. The next stage would be to test this directly in developmental stuttering patients who do not have the comorbidities of Parkinson's or central tremor. That will require an IRB approval here at a university. You first got to get the right team in place. We have the right team here at UC Irvine. We have a deep brain surgeon who's on board. He does about 70 of these cases a year. So he's really very well schooled in placing these devices. He's been doing this for years, very experienced. We just met. We're filing for a grant and an IRB, and we're hopeful that we will be able to implant patients this year. Well, this academic year, probably not by the end of December, but this academic year, I'd like to implant individuals for stuttering. And really, I think if we be able to determine if we have a direct effect on developmental stuttering.
Wow, so you're really going for it then?
We are, yeah, we are. I think there's enough evidence there to be able to determine this, and I believe there's probably enough individuals out there in the community where, you know, this is not first-line therapy. This isn't first-line therapy for Parkinson's disease, which it is FDA approved for. This is not first-line therapy even for essential tremor. You tend to utilize medications and other things first. But, you know, there may be individuals out there who have failed different forms of therapy for their stuttering and would be willing, through the proper consenting and understanding the risks and benefits, to have this procedure done. Of course, it is reversible. There are risks of having brain surgery, of course, and that would all be explained to the individuals. But potentially, you know, this is a reversible probe in that you can just turn it off remotely. There are some, you know, risks potentially of the surgery, but it's very exciting, and you will be able to know essentially instantly if we're in the right target region. We have some targets we think in the brain, where, and what I mean by target, where we actually place the probe. So we're looking at the subthalamic nucleus there from France, that area, and the ventral intermediate nucleus of the thalamus. So we got some targets that we think might work. And this is FDA approved already for Parkinson's and essential tremor, and now for obsessive compulsive disorder. So we're working on hopefully having the devices provided to us for free, so we can begin to do the procedures.
Well, we wish you and the Kirkup Center the very best of luck with that research. It's exciting.
Oh, thanks, Peter.
Yeah, it's exciting to talk about things that are new. So let's take a very quick break and come on back for more Stutter Talk.
Hey, this is Joel Cordy from the Stutter Talk B team. Myself, along with Roisin McManus and Karen Herring, publish a Stutter Talk B team episode about once a month. We talk about the everyday struggles, trials and tribulations, successes and failures of being a person who stutters, along with lots of other topics. You can find our episodes archived at stuttertalk.com.
This is David Mitchell. I'm the author of the book Black Song Veen and a patron of the British Stammering Association, and you are listening to Stutter Talk.
Welcome back to Stutter Talk. I am Peter Reitzis here with Dr. Gerald McGuire, director of the Kirkup Center for the Medical Treatment of Stuttering at the University of California, Irvine. So in the second half of the show, we're going to be talking about your work with acenapine, a pharmaceutical. And you just published a letter in the American Journal of Psychiatry detailing three case studies with people who stutter who have been taking acenapine. Can you summarize your findings, please?
Sure, yeah, absolutely, Peter. So these case studies are just suggestive. Reason we were considering the use of this compound is it is a dopamine antagonist, similar how it reacts to the various different receptors in the brain as other compounds that we've found to be effective, namely olanzapine. When we studied olanzapine, we found it to be an effective medicine in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. But it can be associated with some sedation. It can be associated with weight gain and cholesterol and lipid increases, even though it can be a beneficial medicine and it's still being widely prescribed today for other conditions. Acetaphene gained approval a couple of years ago for the treatments of the bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So it is on the market, FDA approved for those conditions. It has a better weight gain profile, lower risk of weight gain, and metabolic disturbances like blood sugar elevations and lipids and cholesterol than other dopamine antagonists in its class. We said, well, could this be a better tolerated option for our patients who stutter? And we ran the 3 case studies and published those. Of course, we've used it since that time in more individuals who stutter. How we progressed is we've received a grant, and so it's just from financial disclosure. We do have a grant from Merck, the company that manufactures acetaphene. They have given a grant to our university and the Kirkup Center for us to test this medication in stuttering. And that study, we have waited primarily for the placebo matching of pills to be made and delivered to us. Because we're going to find it in a lower dose strategy than the dosages that are marketed currently for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. We believe that stuttering may require a lower dosage than those conditions. Our patients aren't acutely manic or they're acutely psychotic, and they may note the potential side effects of medicine, which still has the sedation, the tiredness that Olanzapine has, but without the significant weight gain. So the medication supply should be sent to our university very soon, and then we'll be ready to start the study. And it will be a double-blind placebo-controlled trial of about 30 subjects. We're going to see how it works. This won't be as definitive as a 300-patient study, but it will give us a signal. We have reached statistical significance before in similar design studies with risperidone and olanzapine with that sample size. The dopamine blockers, at least in the prior studies, tend to have a very good effect size. They tend to improve the percentage of syllable stuttered and the duration of stuttering blocks over placebo with just a relatively small sample size seem to have a greater effect. We've never done head-to-head trials with Pagaclone. The Pagaclone had a less of an effect size, although it would seem to have a better effect potentially on the social anxiety. That worked on GABA, of course, a different neurotransmitter. So we're going to go back to the dopamine blocker now that we have a better tolerated alternative potentially, and we're going to test that and study that.
Now, do you feel that acetaphene is, I'm trying to find the best way to say it, because you certainly don't have all your eggs in one basket, but do you feel that now acetaphene is the main drug, the main pharmaceutical of your focus for the medical treatment of stuttering, or are there others that are potentially equal to it?
Yeah, there are others that hold promise. We do have the funding from acetaphene to actually test this in a double-blind placebo manner. So we'll actually have more data with it. We believe that some other compounds, which are now on the market, can show benefit, that they have not been adequately studied, although they have a similar mechanism of action. These are compounds like ziprasidone. It also has a very good weight gain profile and lipid profile. It has not been adequately studied, and we've applied for grant funding to support that. It's now a generic medicine, so we've never received the grant to actually adequately test that medicine. Aripiprazole, we had one case study of that, and that's an interesting medicine. It may work where other compounds have failed, and that has a different mechanism. It's a partial dopamine agonist, so it works a little bit differently in the brain than the straight antagonist. You can see it work at times. It has a better metabolic profile, the weight gain, et cetera, than some of the other compounds. But in and of itself, that medicine has not been adequately studied, and we don't have a grant for that. There are two other newer compounds on the market, iloperidone, which has a very low risk of muscle stiffness and rigidity and restlessness. That's a potential benefit. It can cause some orthostasis, like a lowering of the blood pressure, but that is a viable option as well, too. We aren't planning a study of that, but we have used it clinically for paid patients and have shown some very good results. Of course, we haven't studied that in a controlled manner. And there's another new compound that has a very good weight gain and lipid intolerability profile, and that is lurasidone, which is also a dopamine antagonist, which we're showing clinically to have some benefit as well. And we're hopeful that perhaps we'll study that medication in the future as well. So it's not that acetylcholine is the only agent, it's the agent that is a unique profile among some of the older compounds. We do have more data with it initially, and we do have a grant to study it. So that's where we're moving ahead with that. And certain advantages to it that it does have that better tolerability profile, has a little bit of risk of some restlessness and tiredness, but those tend to be time-limited. It's a sublingual medicine, so you have to take it under your tongue, but can be associated with somewhat of a bitter taste, and patients may notice their tongue to be a little bit numb for a minute or two. It can have a direct anesthetic effect, but it's a promising compound, but we have other compounds in our class of agents as well.
My guess is that if somebody chose not to take acetylcholine because they didn't like the taste of the pill on their tongue,
yeah,
they probably really don't need it. That's just my guess.
Can you get by, and they have a cherry flavor. It tastes kind of like the cherry cough syrup, but it's actually the medication I'm on right now, I've tolerated it well, and let's study it in a controlled manner and placebo-controlled with objective stuttering ratings, and let's see where we go, right?
Wow, that's really exciting. I'm curious. I don't think I've ever asked you this question before, but can you estimate how many pharmaceutical or compounds do you think are prescribed off-label to people who stutter on a regular basis? Do you think it's 5? Oh. Do you think it's 25? Do you think it's 55?
No, it wouldn't be more than 10. Although, I read the other blogs, and there are other blogs out there now that talk about medication and stuttering. So I read the other blogs, and I receive probably 4 to 5 emails a day from people who stutter from throughout the world who are taking medications for their stuttering. And a lot of times they go to a psychiatrist or a primary care doctor, and they view stuttering as more like an anxiety disorder, and they give them like an antidepressant medicine, which may have some effect on the anxiety, but not a direct effect on the fluency. So they tend then to say, well, nothing's helped my stuttering. So many of those medicines may be tried, but we really don't have great data that they can be beneficial. There are other anti-anxiety agents that work on GABA. They can cause sedation and tolerance and potentially addiction. They can show benefit on the anxiety of stuttering, maybe a slight effect on the fluency, but so those may be prescribed. Really, not many people are using the old traditional antipsychotics like haloperidol, which was studied in the 70s and found to be effective for stuttering, or pimazide, which was also found to be effective for stuttering. So the individuals tend not to use those. We have 10 newer dopamine blocking drugs that have been developed since the 90s that tend to be the ones where individuals may receive potentially therapeutic benefit, and they may be prescribed off the label. Of those, a couple of them have, one in particular has such serious side effects of lowering the white blood cell count I've never heard of it being prescribed for stuttering. That's clozapine. So really you've got about a class of about 9 of them. In that group that I use in my own inventory, that maybe other clinicians out there have prescribed. Of those, the most convincing data that we have in the double-blind studies are with risperidone and olanzapine, and hopefully soon we'll have more data with acetylcholine.
This is Stutter Talk, Peter Righteous with Dr. Gerald McGuire. And as a reminder, you can join the conversation at the Stutter Talk podcast Facebook page. The easiest way is to go to stuttertalk.com and click on Join the Conversation. So, Dr. McGuire, I don't really know how the medical research field works. So have there ever been times where you've really wanted to put together a study on a certain pharmaceutical or compound, and maybe the company that owned the rights to it wouldn't grant you permission, or for some other reason it was turned down? Has that ever happened?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time, yeah. So the key with this is funding. The latest was Pagacom. The funding just stopped, even though we had a very strong signal that the higher doses was effective. So when the company was sold and there was just no funding to go forward, so that was one that just ceased. We've applied for grants through NIH to test medications alone, speech therapy alone, and medication plus speech therapy, and shot down a few times on that. We wanted to test the effects of brain imaging with medications, and was shot down on that. I have to look at companies that make some of the brain imaging technology, and didn't receive grants there. We've even developed in our lab what we think is really a good designer drug for stuttering, and I just need funding to test it in humans, and I have not been able to secure that funding yet. So you need the dollars.
What was the name of that last drug that you...
Well, I can't tell you the name.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Okay.
Because we designed it, and we're trying to license the patent of it.
I understand. I thought you had said the name, and I missed it. Okay.
No, I don't have a name yet for it.
So we'll call it.
So there's a lot of this, yeah.
Okay. Well, then I think Stutter Talk will come up with a good name for you for it.
Well, you know, I was thinking of a great name, Peter. If we ever get a medicine that's FDA approved for stuttering, I was going to call it Conversol. What do you think?
Oh, that's great, Conversol. But it should have the word stutter in there. So, you know.
I was thinking like Fluencia. That doesn't sound so
fluent. Cool. No. Yeah. That kind of makes me want to stutter, so no.
Yeah.
So I don't have anything to base this on, but I am just curious. I mean, would a pharmaceutical company ever turn down research on a compound that they own the patent to because they don't want to be associated with stuttering or other disorders?
Yes. That occurred with me with nimodipine way back in the 90s because it was being sold primarily for... a blood disorder like subarachnoid bleed or hypertension, and they didn't want to even consider this being used for a neuropsychiatric condition, and it never made it there. There's also talk that we never went for indications with these drugs, or never were supported going through an FDA indication because the dosages prescribed in stuttering tend to be lower than the dosages prescribed in olanzapine. With the olanzapine or risperidone and these other compounds tend to be lower than the dosages in risperidone, dosages in bipolar or schizophrenia. And then that would confuse the practicing clinician potentially on what dose to prescribe for these other conditions, which really lead the use of those compounds. So certain things come into play about the potential marketing of the drug and how they would actually position that. Lead to a little bit of confusion if it's, you know, higher doses for this condition, lower doses for this condition. Would that lead then to doctors prescribing a lower dose for that other condition and not seeing the full effect in that other condition? So, so a lot of things have come into play over the years.
I'm not suggesting that that any company has done anything illegal, but I am curious about...
No, there wasn't anything illegal.
No, but I am curious about if a company were to say we don't want you studying our drug because we don't want to be associated with stuttering, I do have to wonder if some lawyer with a lot of time on his hands would want to challenge something like that.
It'd be interesting. I've never had that per se. I've had it where it said, well, we're not going to pursue an FDA indication. We're not going to invest in that because they've done the market research. They don't feel that stuttering is a big enough problem to invest in. That's for sure. In that, how they've done the market research, I think it's flawed. They've gone out to physicians in the community and said, how much stutter do you treat? And they say, mild treatment stuttering. So there's no market. So you see, when in fact, if they polled speech language pathologists or people in the school system and they said, how many people who stutter do you see? And there's a potential market there. But, you know, people who stutter tend not to go to their MD for help.
Sure.
And so if they just pull the MDs, they're not going to pick up that potential market.
Mm. See, I misunderstood you. I thought you said that there was a company that didn't want to be associated with the stigma of stuttering. Okay.
No, not so much. No, just more that it's just not really in their vision. Like if it's a cardiac drug or if it's a drug primarily for bipolar or schizophrenia, they want to focus primarily there.
Well, and I know that you have to run in a second. So very last question for Dr. Gerald McGuire, director of the Kirkup Center. For people who are interested in your work with deep brain stimulation and acetampine and other compounds, who should they call or where should they go?
I'd be more than happy. I try to get back on my emails every day. Individuals can email me directly at gerald.mcguire@uci.edu. That's gerald.mcguire@uci.edu.
And we're going to put your email address up at stuttertalk.com, episode 367. Dr. McGuire, thank you once again for joining us on Stutter Talk.
Thank you very, very much, Peter. I thank you for the important work you do in educating the world about stuttering.